At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
All right, y'all. It's an all-new Keep It. We're tuning in. I'm Iron Madison III. We're live.
Are you like a... Were you somebody who tried out for Do the Right Thing?
Yeah, just
and
a
then
Grandmaster Ira.
And Spike Lee was like, please don't ruin my career. I'm Louis Fertel.
I'm Aida Osman.
I'm the sixth blood.
Oh.
Oh, God.
Have we even talked about that movie? I did see it. Delroy Lindo. Very good. Entertaining. I didn't know it was going to become like an adventure movie. Nobody, like the reviews did not lead me to that. So that was exciting. Yeah.
I will go anywhere that Jonathan Majors is present without a shirt. That's just my one criteria for films now.
Listen, I would have finished Lovecraft Country if that were the case. We'll talk about Defy Bloods later because we're talking about the Globes this week. You know,
my favorite institution. I don't know if you've heard about them, but you can trust them for anything. integrity, golden things, and alcohol. So
Lewis is actually recording this podcast from the yacht that he was just gifted by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. We know, Lewis.
As the executive producer of Sia's music, I am now a proud boat owner.
Okay, but then they did have an autistic person working on the movie, so I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh, God.
I'm kidding, Lewis.
That was good. She had a good one.
Halfway into it, I was like, stop it. And here we are. It's love.
I actually forgot that the Globes were this Sunday, and Lewis and I are fully going on NPR this week to talk about the Globes. And in my mind,
what are you going to talk about?
In my mind, I did not even think, we're having this convo about the Globes because they're this week.
Oh, right. Oh. No, they're just a vague idea.
I'm just
in
like
space
they're
right
there
now.
Somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Damn. Yeah, I'm having the realization as we're talking about it too. I thought we were talking about it because of the scandal, but it's a coming this weekend. It really is.
I feel bad, or I don't know if I feel bad. I'm excited, I guess, for the writing staff who now has to write 10 to 15 jokes about everybody being paid off. So I guess if you write for the Golden Globes, you're already writing those jokes because their whole thing is they're in on it or whatever.
Right. We'll get into all of that. But it is sort of weird how they are a very corrupt institution that just acknowledges that they're corrupt.
Yeah. It's like the judging on whose line is it anyway. The points don't matter.
Before we get this episode started, I do want to point out that I, Ira Madison III, host of The View, do not know when or where I can get vaccinated. And it upsets me.
It's not looking good.
Meghan McCain has now reached that echelon of people who, when they're trending, like Twitter needs to be rebooted, you know, a Piers Morgan, Azealia Banks. Just like, it's like, why? How is this happening? It was a week and a half ago she was last on my feed because she sniveled the words my father as somebody else made a wonderful point.
Okay, but I might be with her. I too am over Dr. Fauci. Don't need to be seeing him every day. I'm tired of that man. I'm tired of him.
You're tired of Dr.
Really?
Fauci?
Yeah, and all the hard work that he's doing. Yeah, I'm tired. Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, you know, this man has been around for so many infectious diseases and outbreaks. When are we going to start asking if he is the problem?
Right.
Dr. Fauci, a petri dish of a man.
Dr. Fauci, maybe he was out there creating AIDS.
In the field.
Maybe he came up with SARS.
You think he's just behind some test tube sprinkling things in and cackling and stuff?
Yeah, he's like...
It's the intro sequence to Powerpuff Girls, but it's Dr. Fauci and he's creating mass illness.
I was going to call him Dr. Blight from Captain Planet.
Oh, I love Dr. Blight. She was the one with hair over her eye. Women with hair over one eye. There's not that many of them in popular culture. Veronica Lake, Dr. Blight, that might be it.
I also think Meg Ryan could play Dr. Fauci.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Mm. Remember how celebrities voiced people on Captain Planet, including Neil Patrick Harris, star of It's a Sin, who we're going to talk about too.
Yeah, we're going to talk about It's a Sin this week, which does reveal that Dr. Fauci was behind AIDS.
Oh.
He's the villain. He's the villain in the finale. So,
I see.
Yeah, yeah. Just a theory, but I love this pseudo-history, you know? Yeah, suggestive history, as it were.
Right.
If you squint, he's actually at the bar at all the gay clubs in every scene. He's there. He's dancing with them. He's cueing the laser beams.
He's actually the main character in Perestroika. So.
Oh, right. He and Roy Cohn just sort of winking at each other.
We are going to talk about It's a Sin this week. We're also going to talk about the hottest movie to hit Netflix in quite some time. I Care a Lot.
Which, by the way, I was set up to like. I was all ready to be into this movie, and then the movie had other plans.
I mean, it's Rosamund Pike in a bob.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I thought that we, you know, made an agreement here, Netflix, that this is supposed to be good.
Yeah, right.
And then, of course, the Golden Globes are embroiled in scandal, as usual. But this is more scandalous than normal.
Yes. Emily in Peril, if you will.
And we will be joined by the very fantastic Roxane Gay to talk about her new masterclass, but also to talk about reality TV.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Ira was involved. And also, they too, they share that. So let them
We love them. Ourselves some Bravo.
Also, if you know Roxane Gay from one type of writing, you can check out any other type of writing, and she has done that too.
Truly, truly. I'm like, girl, when is the poetry slam?
Yeah, seriously. Right. It almost feels like a betrayal when people know how to write in more than one way. Like, I can only do a joke that ends in like 140 characters. You don't want to see me go into a paragraph space. Meanwhile, she can do it all.
Mm. Well, we'll talk to her about doing it all and having it all. As I believe women can do.
Very risky of you. I don't know. You're going to get a lot of ideas in people's heads.
She is Sarah Jessica Parker, and I don't know how she does it.
One of the great movie posters, I will have to say. Isn't she sort of like, I don't know either.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, so it turns out that there was a death this week that we have to talk about.
Huh?
As usual, only this time it is...
We have to.
It is the death of Daft Punk.
Oh. I thought for a moment we were going to have a Rush Limbaugh conversation that I didn't know was going to happen.
I don't care about that,
really
nigga.
I really thought you were setting it up to mourn Rush.
Actually, RIP Rush. He was an inspiration. You know,
I mean, somebody was going to brainwash my aunt. It may as well be that bastard.
No, I meant that my little French electronic duo, Daft Punk, is no more. That was very sad news.
Yeah.
Even though it's not like, you know, they've been doing much since the Tron soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Right. Though they were also the living embodiment of the Tron soundtrack. So you still wanted them around. They kind of were like... the even cooler version of someone like Moby, which is to say you always were hearing their music, always in a commercial of some kind. Mm-hmm. And then they themselves had a sort of mysterious presence. And for example, when they won the Grammy for Album of the Year, that was like the perfect confluence of things the Grammys want to be, which is cool, but then also you would definitely hear Get Lucky at a Wedding. So nobody felt alienated by the coolness.
Right. And also... they've been around for so long, it almost feels like you're awarding a legacy artist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I, you know, was listening to Defunk off of Homework back in high school.
Defunk was, that's the one that was remixed with, I think, Like a Prayer at some point, which for some reason I heard constantly growing up. Maybe it's because I downloaded it and liked it.
Off Kazaa?
Yeah, Kazaa. Kazaa for sure. It is. I can picture the font on the Kazaa I downloaded. Yes.
I feel like a lot of my relationship with Daft Punk has been learning about them after they came into maybe my pop culture awareness after Kanye West brought them to the forefront. So I thought Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger was a Kanye West song. And then going back and discovering all these albums of some of the dopest music I'd ever heard. Like, I also remember after they won the Grammy in 2013, I I just went back and I haven't been able to stop listening to their albums as if it's not new music. Like, I consume Daft Punk every day. Game of Love, my favorite track.
I think because it was awarded, you know, and like Get Lucky was everywhere, right? And it was also sort of that era where Pharrell even became like the old guard, which makes sense because he looks like a character from the old guard. That man is 10,000 years old. But Random Access Memories is such a really good album, you know? And the Tron soundtrack is amazing, too. And I will admit, I have not seen either Tron, which is weird for my brand, but maybe it's not.
No, I would say it's not, actually. It's the kind of thing where the feel of the movie is classic and specific, but I don't know that people are utterly obsessed with the content of either movie, especially now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're talking about even the legacy of Jeff Bridges, I mean, I would go through 10 other movies before you got to that. But also about Random Access Memories, I know what my specific Grammy memory about that is Taylor Swift almost getting out of her chair when they start to say "red," and she thinks they're about to say
"red." Oh, red. Yeah, yeah.
That was
got me
moment.
Again.
And of course, you would pick up a second one.
I'm thinking how pivotal watching the One More Time music video was and all of the the graphics and the animation and thinking, oh, God. Between Daft Punk and the Gorillaz, my favorite music videos to have ever existed.
I always think that the Gorillaz are French, too, just because the first time I discovered the Gorillaz, it was on my...
Is that Gorilla?
Well, it was on my freshman year of high school trip to Paris. And I heard them in a music store and saw their video there on like French MTV in the hotel. So like I became obsessed with them there. And in my mind, I always think they're French because I love a French music group, you know? Mm. I love Air.
Okay. Yes, true.
Yeah. We don't talk about them as much anymore.
Air is very like what would be number three on a Pitchfork year-end list from 2001 or something. I know them from lists.
Giving you sexy lounge music.
Yes, quite.
Which is wild because that is what Daft Punk descended into. They started out very much like, we're giving you futuristic music. And it's like they've influenced so much of like, you know, like the electronic game since then. Their albums descended into nostalgia for the era and influences that they had. Random Access Memories has that song with Giorgio Moroder, the king, you know. And then it's weird to think about them in the context of nostalgia because I was already getting that nostalgia last year because it's from one of my favorite scenes in I May Destroy You when Arabella's sitting on the beach with her Italian lover and There's Something About Us plays. So it was already clicking like a nostalgia twinge in my brain. And I think now that they're gone, that music will start to reflect that way, interestingly enough.
Also, them breaking up was a necessary step in a reunion album, so let's just get to where we need to be for the next project to come out.
Yeah, you're right. It does feel like when people break up maybe earlier than you'd think they would, it is because later there will be a joyous revival of some kind. This is a Pollyanna optimism on my part. This is also me speaking out to REM. Get it together and come back. Yeah.
Some people are very of the mind that like they never want it to be like a museum piece, so maybe they won't come back. But we'll see. Anything
maybe they
can
could come back, do like a Speaker Box Love Below type collab album. Give us two separate understandings of their music and see how it can coalesce. But I don't know. We'll see. 28 years is a long time.
Yeah, that is true. You know who is a huge part of Random Access Memories, by the way, that I always forget about? Paul Williams, who wrote like We've Only Just Begun, like Carpenter songs. And like the fact that they could roll him into this album like really spoke to their like musical literacy too. So look up Paul Williams. The Carpenters did a sorry to bring this back to the Carpenters. I know you're shocked.
Always find a way.
Yeah. So they did a medley of Paul Williams' songs on The Carol Burnett Show with Carol Burnett once. Look that up. That's a great medley.
Mm-hmm. And one of the best songs that Julian Casablancas has ever sang on that album.
Oh, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. He wrote Rainbow Connection too, Muppet Show. Yeah. Or the Muppet movie.
Aw. That's so cute.
It's a great song.
All right.
Lost the Oscar to It Goes Like It Goes from Norma Rae, which I would argue is a better song. You can fight me on Twitter about that one. I'm a veil.
Glad to miss that. In other sad news, I did watch the new Netflix film, I Care a Lot, starring Rosamund Pike this weekend.
They're there.
So that's what I want to know is, should I care a lot? Should I now go watch this movie?
Baby, this movie, it is wild. It has actually been quite a long time since I've seen a movie that like I just was so angry at in the midst of watching it.
And the whole time, too. I would say there's not a part where I'm like, oh, I'm in for right now.
Except for when Diane Wiest threatens Rosamund Pike.
Because, by the way, Diane Wiest, in pissed off mode, underrated. I found her quite commanding. And also, we never get two Diane Wiest movies in a year. And now we have this and Let Them All Talk. Look at, I mean, the last thing she did was that goddamn movie, The Mule, where she had to deal with, you know, that scarecrow, Clint Eastwood.
She's also one of the best parts of Let Them All Talk.
Oh, yeah. Very funny. Very funny. Yeah. Candace, very funny, too. Mm-hmm. No, so definitely, if you want to skim for the parts where Diane is salty, great. However, it is really brutal to get into the movie because it's about a woman who takes advantage of older people and basically forces them to live in elder care facilities where, and then she then takes all of their stuff and money. And then she has a run-in with the mob because Diane has connections to the mob. And I would say both sides of this equation, Rosamund Pike, the scammer, and Peter Dinklage, the mob person, are cliches of cliches, and mixing them up is not entertaining.
So not fun to watch either of them. Peter Dinklage's character really descends into like wacky mob cliche. You know, it's we've already got Smoke and Aces.
Yeah. Oh my God, you just brought me back to when I was an RA and an honors floor, and I was like, I'll put on any movie you want for the fucking movie night, and these losers chose Smoke and Aces. I am still mad.
Like, to haunt you?
Yeah, no,
with
they were
real
like,
real earnest interest?
They're like, Lewis, we love it. You gotta put on Smoke and Aces. And I was like, I believe you. What? Meanwhile, at that time, I was like, can we watch Vera Drake? Like, I had other ideas.
I would give anything to watch you have to deal with a bunch of college boys. Anything.
They were all named Justin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Smoking Aces and the Boondock Saints were a certain kind of movie that straight white college boys were always throwing on.
Totally. They were like way too violent and way too vulgar, but that's it. That's what they liked. There's no upside to it.
Meanwhile, I was the only one over here standing Lucky Number 11.
Oh, are you my brother Mark? He loves that movie too. Is that Josh Hartnett?
It is.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
He always has my heart, Nat.
Okay.
Whenever I leave a workout class, I am embarrassed for being Irish and Polish. I'm the sweatiest person in the room. But when I'm leaving the room, I try to move my hair into place like I did it on purpose. And it's always going for a Josh Hartnett late 90s photo shoot look.
Mm. I thought you were going to say that whenever you're in a workout class, you're thinking of the Josh Hartnett, Harrison Ford scene in Hollywood Homicide where they're in yoga together.
I have not seen that movie and you have inspired me. So.
I mean, that reminds us of a random moment that does not even make our Roxanne interview, but she talks about watching the movie Paycheck. And I'm like, that is from that era of movies that came out when Lewis and I were specifically in high school. And I think we've talked about this before, where you would, because you were in high school and in the Midwest, you would see any movie every weekend, because what else are you going to do? So it's like, this is out. Oh, Roger Ebert gave it 1 star. Guess I'm still seeing it.
Right. No, nothing could dissuade me. It could be February, like just the worst time of the year. The worst movie that people fucking love, we'll move on from this conversation, I'm sorry, is Rat Race. That movie fucking sucks. I'm so mad that people love that
movie. We've argued about Rat Race before.
It's still fresh on my mind.
I don't think on the show. I think just in person.
I think it also supports my theory that queer people like to sit in dark rooms, regardless of what's happening in front of them.
Right.
So we're constantly finding a theater, a light room, just anything that is dark.
I will point out that, yes, it's interesting to have a character like Rosamund Pike who is, you know, sort of like morally questionable. I love villainous female characters. But this character, like, goes beyond villainous to... There's no nuance, you know? It's almost like a wannabe Nurse Ratched kind of character, but there was something so chilling about not really knowing Nurse Ratched's origins in the film, and also she wasn't the main character, right? And you know mm-hmm. she's evil, and you're not asked to sympathize with her unless you're watching Ratched. but this, I'm just like, am I supposed to care about her because she's like, I don't know, licking this other character's box? Like, you find out she's a yeah. lesbian, and it's like, is that the rootable thing about her?
They were like, we need to make her redeemable. make her eat pussy. That's what happened. Okay.
Good instinct.
It's a classic move.
Yeah. No, but you're right. Like, because Rosamund does the evil things with such a straight face, that's supposed to count mm-hmm. as interesting character nuance. But all it is she's horrible. That's
yeah.
it.
Okay, yeah.
And not even in the way that, like, Amy is horrible, but in an interesting way in Gone Girl.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, at least at the beginning of that movie, you think one thing about her. And even if you have suspicions, what she turns mm-hmm. into is not what you expect.
Yeah. This is, you don't learn anything about her, basically. And when she does talk about her upbringing at the end, it's like, this is lazy.
Yeah.
Well, it's written by someone named Jay Blakeson, who is just a old English man. So I don't know what we expected for, you know, these complicated female characters.
But what's interesting is if it were a man, it would be so cliched. There would be so nothing to this person. You would wonder mm-hmm. why there was even a movie about it. Mm-hmm. I also want to add that Rosamund Pike and the roles she's playing, it's sort of like we're treating her like leftover Jessica Chastain in that we give her smart lady roles, like she's played Marie Curie, like very like progressive mm-hmm. women, and then also slyly evil women. And I feel like Jessica Chastain kind of does both those things. But by the way, I definitely prefer Rosamund Pike. I mean, Pike has a kind of, I don't want to say gravitas, but I do want to say weird intensity that is genuine.
I would say it's interesting that you brought up Jessica Chastain, because for Rosamund, I feel like a film like Crimson Peak is definitely a sweet spot for her that I would love to see her in.
Yeah, oh, totally. Yeah, we need more action stuff for Rosamund. That'd be great. Mm-hmm.
This weekend, I also got into It's a Sin on HBO Max, the British series, which finally hit America. It's from Russell Davies, the creator of Queer as Folk. I want to point out that I'm an idiot, because in my brain, I kept delaying watching it because I kept thinking, oh my God, this is from the creator of Queer as Folk, thinking the creator of the American Queer as Folk.
Ah, right.
And I was like, what the fuck am I about to be watching? But no, British Queer as Folk, which was quaint and good. And It's a Sin was... it's a really fun show that I will recommend. It's weird to call a show that is about the AIDS epidemic with some like 18-year-olds in London and how they progressed through the 80s and into the 90s. But I think the overall thesis of this show, and that's hit in the finale of it too, it's only 5 episodes, it's just that we always get these stories about people who've lost their lives from AIDS. But what people really want you to remember from that era is just like how fun life was for gay people back then before this happened.
Mm-hmm. Some of the show reminded me a little bit of Sex Education in the way where sexual discovery is treated as kind of a quaintly fun mm-hmm. thing. You know, there's a wholesomeness to the discovery, even though you associate this era with growing up too quickly and, you know, mm-hmm. morbidity, et cetera.
This show just makes you want to grab all your queer friends and hold them and hug them and kiss them. And mm-hmm. you remember that very specific moment. There's an actor in it. He plays Colin. His name is Callum Scott Howells. He's the Welsh one. He works in the, you know, the tweed shop.
He is so fucking
so
good.
Fucking good.
And so cute, and I had to look on Instagram and like ask a friend, like, is he gay? And then I realized, oh wait, the gay actors in this show are gay. They're being played by gay people.
Exactly.
So that was like, I don't know why that was a shock to me in 2021, but
still, it's like, give him Nobel Prize. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're traumatized. Okay. You're traumatized for the past 20 years. But there's a scene where he is finally at the house, this like queer home that they've all created. And you see the wonder in his eye of seeing all this community and love. Mm. And it just reminded me of those feelings of the first time that I saw queerness represented right in front of me. And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's nostalgic.
Oh, definitely a beautiful montage. Yeah. Where you see him like going from party to party, taking in, you know, like what everyone else has sort of discovered. And there's, you know, a moment like midway through where you learn, you know, like his sort of queer origins. It is, I don't know, it's so sweet and a really beautiful watch. I would say the best part of it is the acting and the direction. The script is a little there, but.
Okay, Lydia West, this girl who plays Jill. Just, I need her to be cast in every single movie.
Yes.
I love this girl. Tessa Thompson, scoot over. I'm sorry, there can only be one light-skinned, curly-haired woman, but at least she's the British one.
It makes me want to go watch Years and Years, which I didn't want to watch just because people kept saying, oh, it's so, like, depressing and for the Trump era, you know? And I was like, I'm not trying to do this right now. But I feel like now, you know, that we're in Biden's America. What else am I going to do while I'm waiting for my check?
Right.
It's truly.
What did you think of this show as a Neil Patrick Harris renaissance?
No. You know, I like Neil, actually. Mm-hmm. I love his acting,
talented,
actually.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Same.
This was a bit too over
much.
The top
it was a bit
for me.
Too much.
He was a character from the Ryan Murphy version of It's a Sin. Let's put it that mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. And everyone else is in a different show.
Yeah, he plays it foppish, which that's what the character is. But it does run slightly into, and I know this is something Neil is probably obsessed with, murder mystery acting.
Yes.
You know, you know, from the dressing to the posture to the, you know, the camp of it. And it, not that people like that don't exist, but...
Of course. It was Nancy Reagan with the AIDS in the parlor.
Yo. All this to say, though, I was so refreshed to see the AIDS crisis happening in London and their view of people in America. Like, there are the scenes where they're just like, well, just don't have sex with the boys in New York and you'll be
yes.
fine. That was like, not a British accent, but that stuff was hilarious to me.
Yeah.
That was like genuine fears that they had, and they were totally justified because nobody knew what the fuck was going on with AIDS.
No, right. I in a Fran Lebowitz interview recently, she talked about how people thought you got AIDS from poppers, which people ingested in all sorts of strange ways back then. If you don't know poppers, I'll explain them very quickly. Amyl nitrates, they're like these sniffable things. Enhanced sex, specifically if you're gay, but anybody can
Lewis
is invited
the
to poppers.
Gay.
Yeah, right.
And like used as like a party drug, a party inhalant. It's like gay whippets.
Yeah, gay whippets. And people would put them on bandanas and like put them in their mouth and inhale them that way too, which is very extreme. But
I've been sort of in the mix of like this 80s like gayness. I was reading Lanford Wilson's Burnness earlier. Yeah, it's just nice to see sort of like a fun, different adaptation of what was going on in that period. And I do want to point out, we talked about Callum and Lydia, but I know Ollie Alexander personally from Years and Years. And
you lucky son of a bitch.
I was like, but I did not know that he had this in him. I was
right.
floored.
Great performance.
I was floored. He is amazing in this show. Like, truly amazing. And I really think the directing and acting elevate the material. And because the story itself could sometimes be a little, you know, like, quaint and trite, but you keep being brought back to the emotion by everyone else involved. And it is, I really recommend this show, you know?
Yeah.
And quick nod to Omari Douglas, who plays what I'm believing is a West African character who leaves his home.
Yes, yes.
I mean, sometimes I get frustrated with those storylines that are like, oh, the black one is from the African household, where they have to strike the gay out of him. Like, I get frustrated by those, but for that experience is pretty real, so I have no choice.
And the stuff with his father ends up actually being like something that broke me. So,
me as well.
Yeah. And it's just, it's nice to see this embracing sort of this new era we've seen of queer storytelling, where, you know, sort of like HIV positive people are telling their own very interesting stories. And I would say one complaint is, I guess it is London, but you know, it's like a lot of white people is again, and like less women than you would expect. And there's always that one saintly woman character who helps all the gays, which
yes,
is true.
The Sharon Gless,
also like,
right.
Or the Aida.
Yeah. She's less.
I've always been the little hag.
She's less three-dimensional than you'd expect because she has to be sort of selfless, right? And she doesn't get to be, you know, full character, I would say, you know, but it makes me love like the writing of people like George Johnson and like the poems of like Donna Smith, you know, seeing people write yeah. about queer people of color in the present who are living with HIV. And I love those stories.
Well, that's what this show excites me about. Sorry, just to say one last thing. What excites me is we'll finally get to see movies about AIDS and HIV where the black characters get to die,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense, because it's not, right now, they don't.
They never get to die. They watch their white friends die because like I get the white creators also are like, well, I can't kill the black person.
I can't kill the black
but
person.
But what I can have them do is be like the local drag queen
mm-hmm.
and like
mm-hmm.
sing I Feel Love or, you know, like some other like Stephanie Mills song to the white cast members.
Yeah, yeah. They can be the Pray Tell of the show and
I also just want to give a shout out to the literal bodies on the show, because sometimes when you watch like stuff about this period, like everybody is like still ripped because we're in 2021. Like if you watch The Normal Heart, people are muscular in a way that did not really exist in 1981.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Matt Bomer, you ain't got no AIDS.
Right. Whereas when I watch the show, I'm like, oh, I feel like I'm in 1981,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's felt. They're svelte. Mm-hmm. In the right ways. Lewis, they have your build, is what you're saying.
I know. I feel, yes. Ectomorph representation, important.
What am I? What does that make me? Endomorph? The one where you just gain weight.
I think that's what an endomorph is supposed okay. to be. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. I'm the warmth. I'm the warmth.
Is that the ghost from Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
Slimer?
Me being, me being Leslie Jones once again.
I love Slimer so much.
Very funny. And fun in the cartoon.
Mm-hmm. Yes. While all that was going on, my 80s experience was an obsession with the Ghostbusters. And I had the Ghostbusters house where you would pour slime on the top. And that's my 80s documentary.
Oh. I just had a portrait of Annie Potts. That was my Ghostbusters experience.
I see that for you.
I would love a web series that you two host, Ira and Lewis, the science gays, and you just explain to the world what's in poppers and how to play with Ghostbusters slime.
It's like a mix of Bill Nye and Drunk History.
Yeah. Right. John Lovett, you're listening. Make it happen.
He's just going to steal it and put that segment in Love It or Leave It.
It's true.
All right, when we're back, we'll be joined by Roxane Gay to talk about her new masterclass. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us. Without us.
Doesn't the Black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Our guest today is a writer, a thinker, a teacher, and a critic. She's a cultural commentator. And now, with her new masterclass, you too will be able to glean some of her brilliance. Please welcome Roxane Gay.
Hello.
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 So democratic of you to dole out the brilliance to everybody else. Everybody's thankful.
So kind.
Well, democratic or capitalistic, one of the two.
Well, I mean, congrats on both fronts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it was a lot of fun to be able to do it because people often ask, can I take a class with you? Which I am flattered by, but generally no. And so this is a great way to sort of let people take something resembling a class in a realistic way where you can't necessarily enroll at the whatever university I happen to be teaching at.
Honestly, I wish that I could have taken, you know, like my grad school classes like this, because I was watching the masterclass yesterday and just like letting you just go. And, you know, I'm just like lying in bed watching it. And I was like, this is a perfect way to take a class.
Yes, it really is. At your own pace. Just do what you want. Mm-hmm.
Also, you look great in it, too.
Listen.
The leather jacket, yes. The swoop, it's all really working.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about Masterclass is that they film their classes like they're filming a movie or a television show. So I had a stylist, and I had clothing options, and they had a makeup and hair crew. And so I was like, okay, I can do this. Because some film and television, they're like, we're not really going to do much and you're going to look like shit. And the answer is no. No, thank you.
And the set is gorgeous too, with all the papers suspended in the air. It is.
Dramatic.
I feel like I'm in your mind. Yeah.
It is. They printed out like 300 pages of my work and then like made this hanging sculptural presentation. It was lovely.
So an Easter egg if you like zoom in.
Yeah.
In
yes.
Class.
If you really want to like.
I'm not buying Bad Feminists. I'm just zooming in the master.
No
class.
Need. It's right there. It's just right there for you.
I want to ask a bit about preparing for this masterclass. You know, we read your recent interview with Monica Lewinsky about writing trauma, which was great. And you've also taught a class about this as well, you know? What goes into, I'm sitting down, I'm going to be doing a master class, and like, I also just have questions about like, how long it takes to even do this, you know? Because I imagine you're sitting in front of the camera talking all day for days?
Yeah, right. The audiobook that never ends. Yeah.
Just about, no. So the preparation process took about 6 weeks leading up to filming, and they flew us to Iceland, my wife and I, to Iceland.
What?
Because it, yeah, they did. Because of COVID, and in Iceland, COVID is under control. Like, people don't even wear masks. It was wonderful. And so first we come up with an outline, and they actually read all of your work and so on and watch a bunch of videos of your work. And so they come up with an outline that you get to then revise and provide feedback on. And you go through that process two or three times. And then they start coming up with lessons and getting more specific. And they just work with you until it's time to shoot the class. And then we shot it in 2 days, which was fine and fun. It was long days, but it was still, I enjoyed the whole process. And you sit across, like during most of it, I was sitting across from a producer who you don't see. Her name is Diane Houseland. And she would ask me questions and I would answer them. And then they like put it all together in a coherent manner. Imagine.
Okay.
And it really is coherent. It kind of feels like it you is. Just sat down for however long it took and read it to us, but it's nice that it could be so concise. I think something I love about your masterclass in particular is, though it's about formally writing for social change, it's also about productivity for writers. And I was wondering, just in the past 10 months, have you been surprised by what you are inspired by as a writer, just having to, I'll speak for myself, I've consumed so much mundane media over time, you know, Instagram, et cetera. Has what you are inspired by changed over the past 10 months or so?
Yes. In that I used to have to really dig deep for inspiration only because I was getting a little burnt out pre-COVID. And now almost anything inspires me because we never go anywhere. And so everything is exciting. Everything. Oh my God, we're getting a delivery? What is it? Who's there? Like, we actually compete for who gets to get the mail. And that's sad, but that's where we are. And so I have found that I am probably, I guess, more open to being inspired by more things than I was before, and that is good. But am I doing anything with that inspiration? Not necessarily.
I feel like, you know, what I loved about listening to your masterclass was that it reminded me of what should be like the most basic tenets of being a writer sometimes, but you need to have reiterated for you. That was just, you know, like researching and making sure you keep track of your research. Like, why is that not something I'm always thinking about? It should be. But I wanted to ask you, what do you do when you feel like your relationship with writings is changing. Like you have to nurture it and you have to remember that you enjoy writing. What do you do when that seems to not be at the forefront?
I try to forget about publishing, and I always try to keep in my mind a separation between writing and publishing because they are two very different things. And so when I start to lose the love for it, when I start to feel like I'm on a hamster wheel, which most writers, you're going to feel like you're on the hamster wheel a lot. So I just try to write something for myself that I haven't already sold or pitched or anything like that. And if there's no one waiting for it, there's so much less at stake. And I can just get to the enjoyment of the thing. And sometimes I just step away from writing for, you know, hours, or I never really step away for days, but I just go and do something else, whether it's take a walk around the neighborhood or watch really terrible television, like irredeemable television, Bling Empire, Selling Sunset, you know, something without any virtue. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be very inspirational.
Bling was very bad.
Oh my God, it was so bad. Like, bless his heart, the dumb one, the dumb model who didn't have any money. I just wanted to hug him every time. I was just like, oh my God, first of all, you're so beautiful, but thank God you have that, because not all God's children are smart.
I've always been, and I think you know because we've talked about it, like a Bravo person. And I've always found, you know, the Housewives, like, at least inspiring and like a good way to view, you know, sort of like you said, how women are viewed by the media and, you know, so how they can be stereotyped in these kinds of shows. But I truly did reach a point in quarantine where I was like, you know what? I don't need to be scraping the bottom of the Bravo barrel. Maybe I don't need to watch Below Deck Sailing Yacht. Unless I do.
Bless me. No, you know what? You actually do. I love Below Deck, but the sailing yacht one was, it was weird. It was not, I just didn't find it as enjoyable. And I'm not sure why. I think part of it was that the head stews weren't as compelling and as messy. And so if there's not going to be any mess, what's the point? But there were also like two of the crew are in a relationship. And it wasn't really fun to see the disintegration of their actual real world relationship against the backdrop of the show. Like, it's entertaining when they meet someone on the show and everyone is on the same page. Like, we're just doing this for the clicks. Mm-hmm. But when it's a real relationship and then reality TV does what it does, it's just like, ooh, I don't know that I like this. Yeah. And also the people were just kind of boring.
Now, I say this as a fan of the shows I'm about to bring up, but we sort of treat like the Below Decks, the Bravo type shows as the most irredeemable, when really I think it is still like Survivor Big Brother, because it's the competitiveness. Like, on a show like Below Deck, it's just those people's lives, right? Like, they're not really fighting for anything. It's like CBS has tricked us into believing, just because it's so popular, that they're, I don't know, above board in some way, but they actually aren't, I don't think.
You know, they're not. What's interesting about those particular shows, CBS really tries to put this like veneer of class on their reality TV offerings, where like there's competition and skill involved.
The stakes are death.
Right. Yeah, I will say, I think Survivor is The Amazing Race are not on the same level as Big Brother. Big Brother is just trash. It's like, let's find the worst people we can imagine and then put them in an artificial situation from which there is no escape and just see what happens.
And usually like two people of color for them to torment and vote out early.
Yeah.
I mean, every time. And then the edits that the people of color get are so unforgivable, and it just makes me, I haven't watched Big Brother in probably 10 years, simply because the black women in particular are never treated right on that show. Yeah. And
well, it is a reality show.
It is. It is a reality show. At least in Atlanta, the black women are treated like people. And over at CBS, which is where black women go to die, no, it's not good.
I also was thinking recently why there's not ever like two queer people, like two gay men or two lesbians on Big Brother. And I realized, oh, it's a live show on CBS. So if a romance breaks out, they would be forced to show it. I think that's
correct.
The reason they don't have
it. I think that's a big part of it. I think it's just, the Highlander mentality of there can be only one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would argue to that one point though, Lewis, that the what I truly enjoy about like the Bravo shows is that they are competitive because you are competing sort of for a storyline and the audience's interest so you can stay. So it is interesting watching the people who are Bravo stars once they've figured out how to survive and become a star of the show from season to season.
It is funny when you're not a fan of Bravo shows and you just hear the vernacular like, she just did that to keep her peach. And you're like, why is losing fruit so difficult? Like, what's the situation here? Like, why?
But yeah, it's a very special peach.
Yeah.
But it's true. Like, my parents are, my mom watches Bravo shows, but my dad sort of only does it because he's married. And it's interesting to talk about the shows with people who really are not as deeply connected with these shows or don't watch them at all. When I start to, like, my wife doesn't do reality TV. And so when I start to explain to Debbie, like, the plot and the reason why we need to watch something, she just looks at me like, where's my wife? Bring her back from whatever place you're in. And then I just have to stop and just say, you know what? It doesn't matter. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I did get her into Selling Sunset. I'm very proud of that.
That's great. To take a brief detour into that too, you know, I think you had recently written something sharing a bit how you had met Debbie and how she had been interested in your work, trying to get you on the podcast, et cetera. I'm so interested, I mean, especially since the other three of us are writers too, like what it's like as a writer to generally have people into your work and into you as a person, but how does it feel different and how do you know it's different when someone is into that but also pursuing you romantically? How do you know when it's different than someone just being like, I've read Bad Feminist like six times and it means so much to me, I have to meet Roxane Gay?
You have to see if there's a willingness for them to recognize that you are someone beyond whatever they know you for. A lot of times, especially I will say this for young women, and I love them, they're great, but they'll come up to me at events and they'll be like, oh my God, we're best friends. And it's very flattering, but, and I try to really honor that because as a writer, you generally, we don't know if anyone's going to read our work, and it's, writing can be so thankless and it's so thankless for so long. Like I spent 20 years in obscurity before anything happened. And so I never take it for granted, but so often I just think, you actually don't know me. You know what you read from a book I wrote 10 years ago. And thank you. But like, it's not enough to really be a foundation for anything other than this 5-minute conversation. And that's okay. You know, and when people like want more, in the olden days, I was just very hesitant because I just thought it's easier for me to stick with the people I knew before 2014 because they know the real me. They know like it's not that great. And so I don't have to try and be anything that they might be expecting me to be because they know the real me. With Debbie, she was just so persistent and she never like let up, and it was like really attractive. And for me, like, you have to be really persistent because I'll never figure it out. And then you have to like spell it out for me in very short words. And so when she was so patient and then we had a really great first date, and I could just tell, okay, she's not just here because she thinks that I am summarized by Hunger, which is the book that she particularly loved. I just knew. And there, she like was looking at me as me. And that was really great. And it ended up being the right choice.
Speaking of people meeting someone based on their writing, you have mastered the art of directness. And because of that, I feel like I never have questions about what you have written. Like, the directness is the point. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, like, you said it. There it is.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, because directness can seem just so without craft, like, you don't have to do it. It just comes out of nowhere, even though it's writing. So it is craft. Mm-hmm. Is that something you had to perfect over a long period of time? Or did being a good writer come first and then the directness? Or was it the opposite?
I would say being a good writer came first. I've been working at writing for a very long time. And I was certainly a very mediocre writer for a long time. And some of my critics say I still am. And so it took a concerted effort in my mid-30s when I just, the older I got, the less interested I am in wasting time. And I just realized, let me just be direct. There's no need to dance around this. I can write well and write strategically and write beautifully and still just get to the point. You know, ambiguity is overrated. I don't need to be ambiguous about the things I care about, especially when I'm writing about race and gender, sexuality, sexual violence. Like, there's just no room there. I can be ambiguous about other things, but not that. And so I just started to try directness, and I had a day job. So I just thought, whatever happens, happens. I don't, you know, I'm not living on this $50 from Salon. I'm just doing what I do, and I my bills are still going to be paid. And I think that gave me the freedom to be direct and to say what I wanted to say, because I wasn't going to pay my rent based on how well the work was received.
Mm-hmm. Your masterclass touches a lot on how you write about trauma and how you warn writers to, you know, make sure they're in an emotionally distant place from their trauma before they start writing about it so they're okay. Mm-hmm. But I've also been interested in, how have you felt? Like, let's say after the Hunger press tour, when you had to talk about it all the time, every day, did that ever re-traumatize you? Or do you feel like you developed an apathy about your trauma and the traumatic experiences?
I think I developed something of an apathy simply because I was talking about it so much. And in different countries, even. And each country would have a different type of bullshit. And so I just had to become a little apathetic just to get through it. You know, book promotion is one of the key ways that you sell books. And so you really don't have a choice if you want to publish another book than to just lean into it and do what you need to do. So it was challenging, especially because I don't mind talking about my books. I wrote them. I'm happy to talk about them. But with Hunger, people really showed their asses. I was not only having to deal with talking about the book over and over again, I was having to deal with true bullshit from people who should know better. I also just had to disassociate a little bit so that I didn't completely pop off at people who I probably should not pop off at. Mm-hmm. But I did pop off.
I was going to say, it's easier said than done.
Yeah, it's so much easier said than done. Like, there are just things like where it's like, oh, man, I'm going to regret this, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so interesting to hear, too, because I also know during the interview with Monica Lewinsky, too, which she talked about how I think she walked out of the Terry Gross interview. Mm-hmm. And you talked about how, you know, Terry Gross just made you so uncomfortable and you weren't expecting that. Mm-hmm. I guess that's another thing about knowing a writer, right? You know, I feel like people would never expect that from the directness you seem to have on social media, for mm-hmm. instance, and then interacting with someone like Terry on the podcast. How do you find that social media can be sort of like freeing in a different sort of way for you to write and communicate your ideas than when you're actually writing? And this is so interesting to me now, you know, being banned from Twitter.
I'm like, why do they keep banning you? It's not right. Free Ira.
That's going on a book jacket now, just to be...
It has to. Yeah, it okay. absolutely has to.
I may have set something in motion.
Travesty.
Just so you know.
Twitter's a mess. The person I am on social media is me. In real life, I'm very quiet and I'm very shy. And I'm fine with that. I'm 46. This is who I am. It's not changing. But on social media, because I, in many ways, grew up on social media as an adult, I'm very comfortable. And I will say anything to anyone at any time. I just don't care. Mm-hmm. And that's freeing to just, and again, I always had a day job, so it just didn't matter. Like, I don't care what you think of me. I clock in at 8 and I clock out at 5. Good night. And, well, not really those hours, but I just had my own thing going on that had nothing to do with Twitter and writing or anything like that. And that was really the best gift I gave to myself. That was the right choice for me because I don't like to be stressed out about money. On Twitter, I don't know what it is, but there's something about the medium that demands concision. And I think when you really want to get your point across, you can. And when you really want to tell someone about themselves, you can. And there are fewer barriers than in real life. I can't tell you the number of people who talk all kinds of shit to me on Twitter and then at a book signing, wait in line and are like, oh my God, I'm so glad to meet you. I'm so-and-so-and-so on Twitter. And I'm like, why are you? Okay, Jack3724. Like, there's none of that sort of ballsiness or courage to be an asshole. And so, you know, I think like most people, it's just easier to say exactly what I want to say to the people I want to say it to. Now, I would say anything I say on Twitter to someone's face, and I have. Mm-hmm. But it does not come easily face to face. It comes easily for me if I can type it. And mm-hmm. so Twitter has done that for better and worse. But, you know, I'm trying to chill out a little bit.
But, I just want to say before we wrap up, I also randomly recently picked up this book on best actress winners, and you wrote the foreword. And I just want to say, I wanted to thank you for that and just was wondering, are you an obsessive film historian person? Are you somebody who's constantly watching old stuff, and what actors do you root for, etc.?
I don't know that I watch old stuff, but I love movies. And pre-COVID, I would see almost everything in theaters. I love going to the theater, especially here in LA. There are some really great movie theaters. Yes. The IPIC in Westwood, I mean, it's just flawless. You just go in. Yes, you just sit, you have your little seat, they bring you little snacks. It's super cute. And so when they asked me to do Best Actress, I have a hard time saying no. And that's why you'll see me write forwards for a lot of things. You'd be like, wow, would not have seen that coming. And it's like, yes, because I was
paycheck.
I was too cowardly to say no. And with Best Actress, I actually just love movies. And I did not write the introduction that they wanted. Because they wanted just something like celebrating best actresses. And I was like, one black woman has won best actress. Let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. And you knew who I was when you asked me to write this. So I don't know why you would think I would do anything but who I am. So I'm now starting to watch a lot of older movies. I had not historically watched older movies. But Debbie's into older movies. And so I've been doing that. And I just like following sort of actors and seeing what they might become. I recently saw Promising Young Woman, and it's interesting to see like where Carey Mulligan seems to be going with her career. And so it's, I do like to follow what actors are doing. Plus, even though they never make it to the screen, I write movies. And so, you know, I like to stay abreast of what actors are doing and who's doing interesting work if and when we ever get to cast something.
I love Carrie. Do not follow her to the dig, though.
Oh, I was just going to ask you if you saw that yet. I haven't seen it.
Like Netflix keeps trying to serve that shit down my throat, and it does not look appealing to me at all.
Even the description to me was a nap.
I was just like, why would you make this movie and then think people would want to, like, who is this for? But I know who it's for. It's for like a bunch of gray haired people somewhere.
Right.
Like, who just want to watch something sweet and gentle. But no, I'm good.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Roxanne.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
We appreciate you.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
After bombshell reporting from the LA Times revealing laughably predictable ethical issues surrounding the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, including having zero Negroes among them, and accepting lavish vacations framed as set visits, and paid huge sums to its members despite being a tax-exempt nonprofit, it seems like a good time to do a deep dive into this year's nominees and the entirety of what the Golden Globes are. They sound like a church. Nonprofit scammers, tax exempt.
Girl, I love a kickback.
Yeah, right. Classic Catholic tactics. I do think the number one funniest thing about the HFPA, first of all, is that, I mean, they're literally members of the press. Like, their whole thing is to be outward facing. Like, the you know, if we can agree what the press does, it's getting the word out. Mm-hmm. And yet, who are they? Like, they're supposed to be nothing but a byline, basically, and yet they are shrouded in darkness still. So that's your first clue that something is amiss.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know what did Ryan Murphy give them for James Corden to be up for the prom? What do you think?
It is 85 people living in Southern California who write or at least have written for non-U.S. publications. And it's just sort of a random assortment of members who don't really seem to have any real journalistic or, like, critical careers. You know, because like you said, Lewis, it's like we don't know who these damn people are.
Reveal yourselves. Did you write for Daily Mail? Do you write for Daily Mail or another publication? I need to know where you journal.
So it's not like you're reading their work and knowing, like, mm-hmm. What these critics even critically think of anything. You know, it's not like the Critics' Choice Awards. And, you know, there was the revelation from the LA Times that there were zero Black journalists, and they allow their members to behave in ways that are unethical, like the Emily in Paris set visit, where they just stayed in, like, nice hotels in Paris. And I'm like, this, of course, that show got a nomination.
Right. Well, I think in general, people are a little bit clueless about how much money just goes to promotion on a movie or a TV show in general. For example, years ago, I wrote for some website that no longer exists, barely existed to begin with. And still, I could have gone to Dubai to interview the cast of The Fast and the Furious. Like, Dubai, like for an interview that you watch in a video, like, do I need to be in Dubai for that? No. But they would still throw money at me, like, writing for nothing.buzz, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got an offer once to, like, be flown to Mexico to, like, interview the set of some movie. And it's like, no, I'm not doing this.
I went to Mexico for Spectre, and I went to London for Steve Jobs.
Wow.
Isn't that bizarre?
Wow, I miss the pre-pandemic journalism world I might have been invited into. I want these kickbacks.
I got sent to Iceland, like Roxane Gay discussed, she was sent to Iceland for masterclass. Like, I got sent to Iceland by like Iceland glacier water once.
Right, what? Frightening. No, yeah. Like, are you in some sort of Icelandic mob now? Yeah.
Oh, so
yeah.
That's where the foreign press is keeping all their Black people. They're just go to Iceland. Be in Reykjavik. You'll be okay.
I do want to say, though, this article paints a necessary and disgusting portrait of this organization or whatever. I still think, though, that the TV side feels way more corrupt somehow than the movie side, even though, whatever, the Sia movie got nominated and the I Care a Lot got nominated, et cetera. I still feel like the TV nominations in general are way more bizarre. And again, you would never, ever remember that a TV actor won a Golden Globe. Like, I look back and I'm like, did John Hamm win or did, you know, it's not even coming to mind exactly. We've all placed them in so little esteem over the years.
Right. There is sort of this notion that we've always assumed or known that the Golden Globes are corrupt, right? And it's always, it's an award show and that's just what the HFPA does. Who cares? You know, and they always make jokes about buying off the HFPA too, you know, but at a certain point, you realize that, like, the Globes are always part of the conversation of what will be nominated for the Oscars, right? Or it's always, like, it's a highly rated award show, so it's, like, movies and actors and things that people are talking about, right? So if you have a certain body that continues to just nominate the same people who, you know, like, lavish them with gifts and other bribes. And, you know, they're mostly white people. You know, what does that say about what's being introduced into the conversation? You know,
right.
I think one of the grossest things they did this year was making Minari be a foreign film. You know, just because they're speaking Korean in it.
Right. And at the Oscars, it's specifically foreign language film, which, I mean, sort of changes the discussion a little bit. But, yeah, I was just thinking about Minari. Good movie. The ending is too quaint for me. I wish they had a different ending.
Love the grass. Very pretty.
Yeah, right.
Love the grass. The house is on wheels. It's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's very, like, Norman Rockwell-y. And, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That Nomadland had me thinking about nature a lot. But the actual opening of Minari, and because it's an A24 movie, you could be forgiven if you thought that it was going to be a horror movie.
Totally. That's fair. Oh, yeah. My God. Yes.
It is very much like a South Korean version of The Witch set in the 80s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If Parasite and Hereditary came together and had a child.
Mm-hmm.
But I will also thank Minari for introducing another young Asian actor into our lexicon after, you know, Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar. Mm. Because now we have two. Now we have two cute, hilarious little Asian boys who are very good at acting.
Yeah. Where's their spy kids?
Right. Exactly.
They're surf ninjas.
Those say the word and that'll be rebooted in like 11 seconds.
I know. Be careful. Yeah. Yeah. You'll have to write it.
Mm. And by the way, there's already like 11 of them, so.
Mm-hmm. Is one of them Shark Boy?
Oh,
not
right.
Taylor Lautner.
Yeah, unfortunately, some of this, to my ears, works in the Globe's favor because now I'm like, oh, I get to watch Tina Fey and Amy Poehler make fun of this now. And mm-hmm. I unfortunately am still really excited for that because how often do we get to see Tina Fey cracking jokes anymore? You know, that feels like this lost era of TV to me almost. She hosted a tribute to Broadway not long ago during the pandemic, but that wasn't really her, you know, riffing about whoever George Clooney is hobnobbing with.
Here's a thing about the Globes that I want to ask. Were all the jokes that we used to hear on like award shows like that, did you always get them? Because there's the idea that, like, I've rewatched, like, the Tina and Amy, the first ones, right? And it's like, so many of the jokes hit more after you're, like, working in
You have access Hollywood, to the level of corruption.
Like, or you've been, like, you know, like, even working as, like, a journalist or, you know, like, a cultural critic. And, like, you're reading more of, like, the trades and, like, just aware of what happens in the city, right? Because a lot of the jokes, you know, like, that Catherine Bigelow one, you know, about like being married to James Cameron, you know, like the general public, like, you don't know James Cameron's an asshole.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You don't know. Maybe the Catherine Bigelow is, you know, the Hurt Locker woman and that we still have questions.
Yeah. I think there might be just an association with the fact that someone, a director of epic movies, would necessarily be a narcissist or an asshole or something. And they're sort of banking on that perception. Yeah, I don't know how much about James Cameron in particular had gotten out by that point. Like, even as I sit here, I'm not thinking of, like, specific instances of him throwing chairs or whatever. I know nothing like that.
But. I feel like the Globes are always fun because, you know, it's part of, you know, like, the in crowd, like, making jokes about one another, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the appeal of it, too. Like, you're peering in on a private party.
Yeah, and also, I actually, you know, I've learned some sense since, but I always enjoyed watching Ricky Gervais just maintain his position as the, like, crotchety, old, hateful comedian. That was always enjoyable for me.
I would have liked it more if he didn't seem above the occasion for me. A lot of the time, I felt the jokes, even if they were fun, like his whole thing was, I'm not like the other celebrities. It's like, you could not be more of a conventional celebrity. Like, you're obsessed with us finding you cool.
You know, they usually have like a television actor or someone too, you know, like making fun of like A-list movie actors. So that's always a benefit too.
Yes. Yeah. That's a fun dynamic too. Like Sandra Oh reaching over to whomever, Julia Roberts. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that like when you have someone like a Tina or Amy, right? Because I feel like SNL is such an equalizer. Or it's like, it's not like a random person in TV or film like hosting it, right? Like if you're part of the SNL cast, it's sort of like you've met a lot of these celebrities when they've hosted.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right. Yeah, the nature of the show is you're adjacent to A-listers anyway, and A-listers don't think you're weird.
Yes.
You know?
something Lewis can't say, right? Jimmy Kimmel.
That's exactly
Did you get to meet a lot of the guests on the show, or were you were you like, you know, somewhere in a corner just, here, Jimmy, hear my jokes?
No, actually. I've only ever talked to one guest on the show because I knew him personally. That was it.
So they don't, like, the writers don't have full access.
No.
To the people. Okay.
It would be so weird if we did, too.
It would be weird.
The way we're dressed, it's just not right. Yeah.
Miss Blanchett. Hello.
Oh, my friend was a PA on Kimmel at one point, and Cate Blanchett did wink at him. What the fuck?
Oh, wow.
Like, you get to die with that memory? I'm so mad.
Yeah. I absolutely love her. I mean, I think I've told the story before about when I profiled Taika Waititi for GQ and, like, was interviewing the Thor Ragnarok cast. And, like, you truly haven't lived until your phone rings in your studio apartment in Virgil Village, and it's, hello, Ira, it's Cate here.
Oh, God.
Spit take. You can't see me, but I'm doing a spit take.
And then being on the phone with Chris Hemsworth, child.
And he has a very sexy voice, too.
Truly.
Sexy person.
Truly, yeah. Truly.
Hi, hey, Ira. It's me, Chris.
My Crocodile Dundees were wet.
Oh, good Lord.
End the segment. End the segment.
All right, well, we're back. Keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. What are we saying Keep It to this week?
Mine's quick and dirty and related to a show we have actually talked about, not ad nauseum, but quite a bit. Johnny Come Lately's on Twitter, and I am talking mainly about gay men who are, I'll say, about 5 years younger than I am, who yell things like all the awards at Catherine Hahn on
Oh my God. WandaVision. This was going to be my kid.
No! Has that ever happened before?
Yeah, I love this.
People talking about the Renaissance because they've just discovered Catherine Hahn.
It's like, okay, we love the woman. Yes, she's great. She's the other Anna Gasteyer, but not like Anna Gasteyer at all. Put that together. But on this show, like, if you haven't seen the new WandaVision episode yet, I don't want to spoil the whole thing, but she becomes a much more significant character in a way. And she's been the nosy neighbor in the first couple episodes in the vignette-based TV parodies they're doing, which, if you know the format of the show, turns out to mean something totally different later on. But guys, what happens to her on the show is not an acting triumph. Literally, it is a plot twist. That is that. She does not deserve Emmys specifically for that. And I just want to say in general, can we avoid just anybody on Twitter or disregard the opinion of people on Twitter who use the phrase all the awards? What the fuck does that mean? First of all, there's not that many. So stop pretending they deserve all of them.
Nobel Peace Prize to Catherine Hahn. Okay?
Yeah, the Pritzker Prize. Yeah. The Spingarn. Yeah.
Eminem NASCAR Award.
Yeah. I think we should find a way, and by we, I mean not me, because I'm not the person who's saying these sort of things, so you have to sort out who we is in this scenario. We need to find a way to key into the language of hard standing and get to a correct level of appreciation for someone like Catherine Hahn. It jumps from 0 to 1,000 immediately, and there could be something interesting to be said about the kinds of roles Catherine Hahn should get in the future based on this show, for example. And I feel like the conversation is halted as squee, to use an old internet term.
You're expecting other people to have the same level of tact as you, and it shocks me every time. It shocks me every time.
I believe it's optimistic. That's what I believe it is, and I'm going to stick with it. Though you're right, I'm doomed.
Lewis wants everyone to possess his austere restraint. You are Mrs. Danvers.
That's right. In my head-to-toe black frock, nodding at Catherine Hahn's talent and then moving away to the drawing room.
I just wish the stands were funnier. You know, like if they stand Catherine Hahn like the Barb stand Nikki, that'd be funny. You know? Go and dox someone in the name of Catherine Hahn. How about that?
You're right.
Really show your devotion.
Yeah, I want some content that has show some mastery of what she's done in the past, even if it's just a couple of roles. Have you seen that weird movie, The D-Train, with Jack Black? She was great in it. Bring up something else. It's, you know, it's like with Laura Dern last year. Do you know anything about her for real? Anyway.
Still one of my favorite moments of when I used to be on Twitter. When I tweeted after she won the award, I said, this Laura Dern seems great. what's she been in?
Oh, and people are responding like, you have to see Jurassic Park.
Yeah. People who followed me too, like, come on.
Really disappointing.
I stand enlightened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess I need to come up with a new keep it while Aida's doing this. Although my keep it was technically to the fact that I try to avoid the spoilers for WandaVision since it drops on Friday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes like you'll watch Drag Race and like Royce and I don't get to watch it until like either right before Drag Race or Saturday morning just because we're working during the day on Friday. But specifically when she becomes the more significant character this week, social media, like Instagram, is like flooded with like the exact scene that is the twist. And I'm like, I get it. I know that you're watching this television show. You don't have to drop the entire scene wholesale into your story on Saturday just to let people know that you've seen it.
Right, right. No, the people that are most
because now you're ruining it.
The people who are most defensive about being able to post immediately after an episode comes out of anything always have the least to say. The people who do it on about Drag Race, it'll literally be like, so-and-so won. I'm like, that's not a discussion. You're just saying what happened.
You just got to be the first person to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I will never forgive that half of Kacey Musgraves at her concert the night that Trinity and Monet won. I'm at her concert. Drag Race is DVRing, and she brings out the queens who just won Drag Race. I'm like, bitch,
the
show is airing.
We're at the concert. Yeah. That's we can't wild. See it. Yeah.
Aida, what's your keep it?
Wow, I'm sorry. I'm so frazzled that Kacey did that to you, and I'm going to go to her home, her cottage, wherever that's at, and smash her acoustic guitar for you. Okay, my keep it's a little bit serious, but it's also just rappers doing stupid shit as per usual.
Azealia? Engaged to a Jewish man and calling herself the Juicy Diva?
No, if anything, that's behavior I support. So... the other day, I was sitting in my room thinking about who was going to be the first idiot to make an insensitive Kobe lyric. And I knew it had to come because it's been about a year since Kobe's passed. And, you know, rappers love to get their little bars off. They need to be the first one to do it. Mm-hmm. And then Meek Mill does a song with Lil Baby.
Of course it's Meek Mill.
Of course it's Meek Mill. I don't know what rock that man is living under. I don't know what society he's living in. I know they don't have leg machines there. But that's, I'm going to move on. He releases a song recently. With the lyrics, this bitch I'm fucking always tell me that she love me, but she ain't ever showed me. Yeah, and if I ever lack, I'm going out with my chopper. It be another Kobe. Nigga, what does that mean, first of all? What does it mean? I'm really struggling to put the pieces together. Two, it has been a little bit over a year since Kobe has passed. His family is still mourning him, and you didn't even have like the wherewithal to be clever. Like, that's so disrespectful. And I immediately, when people started talking about it, he came to social media and was like, you guys are spinning a narrative. He didn't say that. That's a lot of words. What is this, zombie land? And everyone was so irritated with him. And the best part of the story is Vanessa Bryant, you know, the mother to Gianna and Kobe's widow, and just overall wonderful woman, said, I am not familiar with any of your music, but I believe you can do better than this.
Wow.
I just...
Sadly, you know what? I was going to say sadly he can't, but you know what?
He can't.
Going bad was it.
Ira, this is not the time. Okay. Let us have a moment. This man is out here re-traumatizing people, re-traumatizing this family that is still grieving the loss of their daughter and husband and father, and just, it blows my mind.
It doesn't even make sense, too. Because, like, oh, you're disrespecting, so I'm going to go out like Kobe on the chopper.
What?
So you mean you're going to get on a helicopter and then the pilot will fly unsafely in weather conditions? Like
what?
What is the leap here?
Seven people died. Yeah. Seven people died for you to get a really cold 16.
See.
Like, that's insane.
You know what?
Did he really use the phrase Zombieland?
Yeah, he really said it's like Zombieland.
Okay, here's the thing though. That is Abigail Breslin's best credit. You need to let her have that. Okay, so stop throwing Zombieland under the bus too.
You know what? If you're gonna like once again be like the Barbs, if you're gonna make fun of a dead person, you know, look no better than Nicki Minaj's like MJ's doctor. They killing me. Propofol. I know they hope I fall.
First of all, that's a bar. Yeah. That's a bar. She waited the respectable 7 to 8 years until we got healed from it and we were ready for the humor. But well, I'm not ready for no Kobe jokes.
And she did it on a Beyonce track, so you know that was cleared with Joe Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Joe Ghost wrote.
All right, that's our show this week.
Ira, did you do a keep it?
That's mine. My keep it is to the WandaVision stand.
Yeah.
Leave me alone. Spoil the episode later. And spoil Drag Race later. And actually, to the UK queens of Drag Race who dropped their looks like Thursday morning before like Americans or even people in the UK can like get to like watch it on the World of Wonder app, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it.
He is mad. But I think we should actually team up on Keep It's more often. I feel like they add something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, team Keep It's.
We're Team Rocket.
Okay. Oh, right. Now, see, I'm not Pokemon in any way. If I'm on a dating app and someone is into Pokemon in some way, I'm like, this can't work out between us.
First of all, how fucking often do you get on a dating app and someone's like main thing they present about themselves is loving Pokemon?
More than you think.
What are the gays up to?
If you were born in the 1989 zone, it's probably a part of your identity. And like you're talking about like grass Pokemon or whatever the groups are. Guys, they're just like mediocre cartoons. I don't know what to tell you.
You know those bottoms on Grindr love to catch it all.
Right.
Yeah. And I have a feeling Mewtwo is gay representation.
That's tea. That's tea. He did murder Rita Ora in Detective Pikachu. That is gay history.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Beyonce's revenge. Mewtwo was Beyonce's revenge.
All right. That's our episode. Thank you to Roxanne Gay for joining this circus. We'll see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Caroline Reston, and Brian Semmel is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. I think I've heard of him. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week. Stay safe. Be blessed. God loves you.